Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Jose Older is a New Orleans writer. We can say that now. He has had a career that includes music with his band Ghost Star, activism, and writing. He's made his mark in many literary ways as an editor with the award-winning science fiction and fantasy anthology, Long Hidden, Speculative Fiction from the Margins of History. He's written for adults with his Bone Street Rumba series of speculative thrillers in a very otherworldly New York, for young adults with his Shadow Shaper series, and now for middle grade readers in Dactyl Hill Squad. That's what we'll be talking about today. Daniel Jose Older, welcome to The Reading Life.
It is so great to be here.
So I'm so happy you're here all the time now.
Me
so
too.
What's your New Orleans story? How did this happen?
Well, it goes back a long time, like most New Orleans stories.
Yes,
they
do.
When I was 18, I took a year off after high school. Bought a beat-up Toyota and drove to California. And I took my time getting there, and the third or fourth stop was here. And I fell in love and with the city. I didn't want to leave, but I was determined to get to San Francisco. And I felt like that's where I was supposed to be. Destiny was calling, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I really did spend just enough time to be like, I'm coming back. I'll be back, you know. And I think it does it to a lot of people. You know, it really just captured me. So I was in Brooklyn for 14 years.
Yeah.
And I love Brooklyn deeply, but it just became time.
Oh, I'm so glad. Now, before we talk about the new book, let's talk a little bit about some of your earlier work.
Yeah.
Your Shadow Shaper series for young adults is a fascinating look at these young people who attend Octavia Butler High School, which I love. And that school is named for one of your literary heroes.
Absolutely.
And these kids have some very special abilities. So I want you to talk a little bit about that atmosphere.
So shadow shaping is basically the power to bring art to life using spirits. Mm-hmm. And our hero, Sierra Santiago, finds out that she's part of this legacy of shadow shapers that had been denied to her basically over some kind of patriarchy machismo crap.
And basically. Right,
basically. So she has to reclaim that legacy. And as it happens, she's a muralist. And so the art that she brings to life is paintings on the wall that she creates. And a lot of that comes from this really powerful, I think, art form of memorial murals, you know, mm-hmm. and that's always struck me. I was a paramedic for 10 years and we would drive past, you know, the murals all over Brooklyn for folks who had died. And it always just really hit me as such a powerful testament to people's lives who don't get New York Times obituaries, who don't get, you know, if anything, they get criminalized in the news, you know, or they just don't get remembered in any kind of media. But the neighborhood remembers and mm-hmm. people remember. And what a powerful form of resistance that is. I always think of Eduardo Galeano. He says a time of mandatory or enforced amnesia, right?
Yes.
And how real that is when we think about who lives, who dies, who tells your story, mm-hmm. as the Hamilton quote goes, but also just who we're allowed to remember and whose memories we're allowed to honor. And that's also why it's a ghost story in a way, but it's also a reclamation of ghost stories, right? The ghosts aren't the ones that are coming to kill the good guy, but they actually come and help out Sierra and literally lift her up and protect her.
And impart knowledge.
And impart knowledge, you know, and I think that's a role of ancestors that we skip over a lot when we just make ghost stories the bad guy. Mm-hmm. Ghosts, the bad guys in ghost stories.
Now, one of the things I love about these books is that they're so diverse in characters, mm-hmm. gay, straight, young, mm-hmm. old, all races and ethnicities. And I think so much of young adult fiction is about power, you know, how to get it,
how
to use it, how to push against your own boundaries.
Definitely.
And make difference in the world.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's so important. I think power is really fascinating, period, right? But even more fascinating when we're talking about young people first coming into their own sense of power in a world that has denied them that power for so long. First and foremost, well, for many different reasons, right? But certainly when you're young, for a lot of reasons, some of them good, you don't have certain forms of power. Mm-hmm. And then as you become aware of those things holding you back, you also see the different forms of oppression that you're living under besides just because you're young. And so a lot of these are stories of young people really taking a step forward into adulthood and understanding the world for what it is and understanding how to raise their voice in that world. So for Sierra, it's through murals and using art to literally save her life, you know, which is, of course, also about art symbolically saving our lives, which it does, I think, again and again, especially for young people who often don't have an outlet or don't have people who will necessarily hear them out or let them be their authentic selves. Sometimes they have to find it in art.
Yes. The other thing you do so beautifully is create this total sense of community. Mm. And you add to that with such great descriptions of food and festivals and music and celebration. It's all the good and the bad.
Right.
you know what I mean?
Exactly. And that's, I'm glad you feel that, because that's really, community, I think, is just one of the most important pieces of life, but of also literature, and something that has been left out a lot, particularly in a lot of genre literature. We've been so obsessed with the one and only and the individual and the rugged, you know, one that can save the world, one ring to rule them all, over and over again. And I think when we do that, we miss out on this really fundamental aspect of life, particularly of in marginalized communities, you know, where community itself is what often saves our life. That's what holds us down. You know, that's what keeps us sane a lot of the time. And so it's so important. That's why Shadow Shaper and Dactyl Hill Squad and all of my books, even if it starts with an individual, a character like Carlos in the Bones of Roomba, right?
Yeah.
He tries to be the lone wolf because he's that noir hero, you know, he's the investigator. But no matter what he does, people are drawn to him and he's drawn to other people. And he ends up with this huge community of the living and the dead all around him who are all kind of down for the cause. And
such an engaging spirit world.
It's fun.
I mean, he's
so
really
fun writing it.
I'm very drawn to him. He's just
he's a magnetic character.
He
is. And he's, you know, he's a mess, but he's cocky, but he's very self-aware, but also not. He's, you know, he's a lot of different things and he's half dead and half alive. And
I know. That's really a powerful metaphor. Let me tell you.
It's a lot there. Yeah.
Now that I think about it, so much of what I love about your books is this nonstop action, which I think probably comes from those years of being a paramedic and speeding around, you know?
Yeah. I think what really I think I brought from that experience a lot of anyway was the bureaucracy of life and death. And so when Carlos is dealing with, in the Bone Street Roomba, dealing with, you know, the Council of the Dead just being so maddeningly bureaucratic.
Right.
And he's there like, I'm just trying to do my job. I'm trying to like figure out my life and do my job. And they're like, wait, but you have to fill out form 872 because you just, you know, took out a spirit. And he's like, dude, there's so much shoving into boxes, you know, shoving the complex truth of humanity into these just ridiculous little boxes that don't make sense, that is part of being a paramedic, that you're like, this is not what I signed up for. You know, I signed up to do something good. And of course, paperwork is a thing. I get it. I'm not saying it should be anarchy, but it was pretty disheartening to realize just how much like business and politics were. Those were the stressful parts of it. People are always like, wow, you're a paramedic. You must see, you know, how do you sleep at night? I'm like, I sleep great. You know, I save people's lives.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I'm tired. Right, exactly. But the stressful parts of that job are more dealing with the politics and the BS than actually dealing with the medical emergencies, which is what you're there to deal with, right? And when you do that, you feel like I have fulfilled some of my purpose. Even if the person didn't make it, you put yourself into heart, soul, body, mind. You really like entered into that situation to do the right thing by that person. And there's a form of cleansing that happens when you do that, whether it's just by taking part, right? People will say, oh, you see so much stuff.
Yeah.
It's like you see it, but you're involved in it. And I always tell them, you know, if I were to walk down the street in the years that I was a medic and see someone get hit by a truck and not have my equipment and really not be equipped to do anything except call 911 and do CPR, I would take that home with me. You know, that would give me nightmares. But when you see much worse in the street, but you're not just seeing it, you're involved with it. You're really literally just like, you know, elbow deep in it sometimes. And sometimes you save a person and sometimes you don't, but you know that you were there and you did something. But I feel like when that moment that you take part in some way, whether it's showing up at a rally, organizing something, speaking out online, you know, writing, those are ways that you're participating, and those heal some of that trauma of existing in this very broken time.
Well, it's a great gift to be able to portray that in these books and to give these characters such agency, particularly very young characters,
right?
You know, And I especially like that the girls are so powerful.
They have to be.
We run the world.
It's true.
You know.
Y'all run the world. But, I mean, we don't see it enough. And I think when we do, it's often really diluted into just like being badass. Mm-hmm. And that's not really a character. You know, that's just it's an opposite. And I think
it's
sometimes
an attitude.
It's an attitude, right. Yeah. And I think sometimes, particularly writers who aren't women, do a thing where we just are like, well, if we do the opposite of the stereotype, then we're cool. You know, and it's like, it's much more complex than that. Like, mm-hmm. you still have to make a real vulnerable human that's a character. That's, you know, what matters, right? Is that it's someone that feels like they're flesh and blood and not just like a stand-in or a sex symbol or a badass. Like, mm-hmm. there's so much more to it.
And you continue all that in your new book, Dactyl Hill Squad,
yes.
which is an amazing literary mashup. I mean, instead of Pride and Prejudice and zombies, you have Civil War and dinosaurs.
Yes.
So, please, where did that come from?
You would think I'd be ready for this question by now, but I still end up just chuckling because it is really absurd. I think it's that I wanted to write a historical novel, but I also didn't want to write a historical novel at the same time. I'm really fascinated and low-key obsessed with history.
Yes, you are.
Yes, but the okay, so there's two parts, and then I was like, dinosaurs, you know, like I'm a fantasy writer, really, first mm-hmm. and foremost. So I see things through the lens of myth and magic. And so when I added dinosaurs into the mix, on the one level, it just excited my imagination to the point that it allowed me to just jump in full, you know, hearted into this story in this world because I felt like that spark of creativity.
Right.
On the other hand, strategically speaking, I sort of tricked myself because I thought that I was also adding the dinosaurs sort of as a means to allow myself a little bit of wiggle room with history. Mm-hmm. Never mind that a lot of historical fiction writers give themselves plenty of wiggle room without dinosaurs. But I felt like, okay, because if anyone challenged me, it's like, oh, Gettysburg actually happened a month later. Whatever, I can just be like, were there pterodactyls there? You know, it's just not it's not a good answer. But in my head, I was like, that you know, that allows me to be like, it's a fantasy. What happened was, though, I got totally, totally involved and in love, just fell in love with the historical aspect of it. And I just ended up reading way more books than I had to. And just, like I said, getting kind of low-key obsessed with that period of time. And so then it just became pure, like, enjoyment and of history, love of history. And there's so much more history in Dactyl Hill Squad than I ever thought I would end up putting in there because that period is so rich in New York. I originally thought it was going to be like the first third was going to be in New York and then they were going to head down south and be in battle. But there was so much amazing history of specifically of people of color, specifically, you know, Black New Yorkers being heroic and organizing and stopping the forms of slave trade that still existed in New York, even though slavery wasn't there. You know, technically wasn't there. There was still so much going on with the international slave trade and state violence and people, you know, literally kidnapping New Yorkers off the street and sending them south to slavery and all that. But there was organizing around that. There were people that understood the law. Some of them were illiterate, but still understood the legal system well enough to win cases in New York courts. Mm-hmm. They were taking physical action to stop kidnappings. They were super organized. There was underground railroad stops. You know, there was so much and we don't see it. We don't get that in our history books. We don't see movies about it. And that was a lot of the project of Dactyl Hill Squad, from this to the sequel, you know, where we talk more about the Black Union soldiers, is about just digging up those histories that white supremacy has buried, even when it's the kind of like northern form of white supremacy that's like, well, you know, we did what we could or whatever.
Yeah.
There's so much nuance to talk about there, and there's so much more to get into than we have in our history book.
You give so much agency to your protagonist, Magdalise Roca, who's a young woman who's living at the Colored Orphans Asylum in New York. Mm-hmm. So set things in motion for us with her. I love her.
By the way, you pronounced her name beautifully.
Thank you.
I'm impressed, which matters a lot to her, as you know, from page one of the book. Right?
Names are important.
Names are very important throughout the story. And that's where we begin, is the head matron of the orphanage calling her the name that she made up for her, the anglicized version of her name, Margaret Rochford, And Magdalise saying again and again, that's not my name. I'm not responding to that. But it's the field trip day. Varney is the orphanage's triceratops, and he takes the wagon with the kids in it to Lower Manhattan, where there's a Shakespeare performance going on that Magdalise really wants to see, because it's this famous Black Shakespeare company that's based on the African Grove, which was a real early New York. Actually, this was in the 1830s, a little more.
I love that part.
Amazing, right?
It was like, really
another
amazing
history that's so important that we talk about. So Magdalise loves the theater. She wants to go, but she's annoyed by the name thing. Finally, she's like, all right, I'm going, and runs after, but Varney's already leaving. And in her head, she's like, wait, don't leave without me. And Varney stops. And she's like, wait a minute, did the Triceratops just listen to my thoughts? And so thus begins this journey with the most incredible dino wrangler in all of the world in 1863, Magdalis Roca.
Boy, when you think out of the box, you are way out of the box. I mean.
And then the draft riots happen, right?
Yes.
And things get burnt down and it's a whole mess. But yeah.
It's a battle between good and evil that
it
you will
is.
Never forget.
It
I
is.
Mean.
That's it. But there's dinosaurs.
But you really did pull in some exciting, real history into this book, which
yeah.
I loved.
So Richard Ryker is a really, he was a city magistrate, and he was part of this group called the Kidnapping Club, which would mm-hmm. literally snatch Black New Yorkers off the streets and send them into slavery. And he had the law behind him. I wanted to come up with my own bad guy, but he was too
he was
viscerally
right there.
villainous. I think there's always a tension, or there's sort of a dynamic for a writer writing history where you're like, for me, some of the, and I explain this in the end note, you know, some characters are just totally made up. Some are inspired by real life people like David Ruggles, and some are just directly from history. And Ryker is someone who was so villainous and so proud of his villainy and sort of honored for it that I thought it was really worth just having him in there as it. Now, we don't know if he was good at riding a Tyrannosaurus or not, but he works as a character, as someone who's organizing this vast kind of, I mean, it's called the Kidnapping Club. You know, like it sounds
yeah.
like a middle grade bad guy story
it
already.
It really does.
But I would say that Magdalis is based on some of my research on the Colored Orphan Asylum. There's this little like one paragraph in Leslie Harris's book, In the Shadow of Slavery, mm-hmm. that just mentions that a family of Cuban girls, all sisters, were just dropped off at this orphanage and then picked up a couple of years later and kind of mysteriously whisked away back to Cuba. We don't know anything else about them, right? But for me, I was like, oh, a Cuban in American history. You know,
yeah.
like this was a huge like moment for me. This is part of how I found myself in the story. It was through mm-hmm. this moment. And so a lot of the work is, like I said, it's this reclamation. It's saying like, wait, what if these characters, what if we knew more about them? And since we don't, we have to make it up.
Yeah.
And since we have to do that, we better make it fun. And we better make them heroes, because I'm sure that they were, because they survived.
Mm-hmm. What if is the great question always, isn't it? You know, it's what gets us started down the road.
Right, right. Oh. These little moments. Mm-hmm. That I think that's so fascinating. If you talk to different writers, how, you know, these different little pinpoints of moments will just suddenly set off this whole journey.
Your audience is getting younger over time.
Right.
So what's next?
That is a great question. The book I have coming out after that actually breaks that tradition, because it's a literary novel.
Yay!
Yes. I put literary in quotation marks.
Of course.
Because no one knows what that means. It's not genre. I'll say that. It's called The Book of Lost Saints, and it comes out from Imprint Books, which is an imprint of Macmillan. And it's narrated by the spirit of a woman who disappeared during the Cuban Revolution and has now reemerged, kind of haunting her nephew in 2003, New Jersey. And her nephew is this kind of like mess of a dude who's a DJ. He's a really good DJ, but he's also a hospital security guard, and he just isn't doing that much with his life. But she needs him, because the only way she can figure out what happened to her is by giving him moments of her life in his dreams. And so she starts to relate her story and figure out her story as she's relating it, and eventually goads him to go back to Cuba to find out what happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Hill Squad does continue, and the sequel comes out next spring.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
The spiritual life is such an important element mm-hmm. in your work. It always has been.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about.
Sure, sure. So I was raised Catholic and Jewish, so there's a lot of spirit right there.
Yeah.
Right? But right now I'm practicing Santero, and that was part of my family history that I kind of had to go find out more about and explore. That's what really spoke to me spiritually more than either of the traditions that I was raised in. I mean, I'm still Catholic and Jewish in certain ways, for sure. But my spiritual life is really as a santero that does a lot of the work around ancestors and the
yes.
conversation around ancestors. We have a very deep and kind of, I would say, conversatory relationship with spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And for santeros in our houses, we have altars up for our ancestors. When we cook, we put down food for them. When we're confused, we smoke cigars with them and we hang out with them. You know, so again, it's not them jumping out of closets to eat our brains.
Right.
You know, let's talk about what's going on in life, since mm-hmm. you guys have been through it all.
What do you know that I
need to
know?
Let's have a conversation, right?
Yes.
And I think writing is a lot like prayer in that sense of you're in conversation with the universe.
See, I think reading is a lot like prayer, too.
Absolutely.
You
right.
know?
And that's the thing. That's what's so great about both those things and about prayer, is that it's not one thing or mm-hmm. another, right? And prayer itself, sometimes we simplify it to just be like, it's almost like dictation, or you're just saying something to this void.
are the grace of what's coming through you.
Absolutely. Too, right. Which is one form. Prayer is also listening. Mm-hmm. And prayer isn't always asking for something. Sometimes prayer is saying thank you. I think that's the most powerful prayer that I know, is to be grateful on a daily basis, right? And be present. That's a form of prayer.
Well, don't you find New Orleans to be conducive to the life of the Spirit?
Yes. It is. New Orleans is so full of Spirit and spirits. And I just think it's a city that embraces that about itself.
Yeah.
Both in the fact that it's in love with its own history in a complicated way, I think. Mm-hmm. Not in a simplified, corny way, but in a very real way, depending on who you're talking to, of course.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's fascinating. And towards the middle of book two, in the sequel of Dactyl Hill Squad, they end up in New Orleans.
Oh, right.
Yes. So book two.
Dinosaurs and all.
Of course. Yeah, there's giant turtles pulling the streetcar up and down St. Charles. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of, they end up in the Atchafalaya swamps and all kinds of stuff.
That will be an adventure we'll all look forward to.
A lot of fun. As you can tell, I had too much fun writing it.
I had a lot of fun reading
it. I'm glad.
I'm beyond middle grade reader. Right.
I think adults will get a lot from it.
Now, one outgrowth of your spiritual beliefs and your spiritual mm-hmm. life is your total commitment to activism. I mean, I first read your work in this wonderful essay you wrote in Jessamyn Ward's terrific anthology, The Fire This Time.
Yeah.
And that was a great statement of purpose and a great statement of hope.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you talk a little bit about writing that.
Oh, yeah. That is about hope. I think that's a really good way to frame it. People often ask me on panels about why no one writes utopias, right? Because dystopia is such a thing.
Right.
And part of it is just because that would be boring, I think, honestly. Like, it wouldn't make for a good, might make for a good treatise. And also, I think there's a piece of it wherein the idea of a utopia is generally built on the backs of others when we get down into it. And that's a whole other conversation. I say that to say, in those moments in the thick of the Black Lives Matter movement, when, you know, we were taking over streets and laying down, you know, in crossroads and really changing the world and being very visible, and it was just very spontaneous and true. Mm-hmm. It was a moment that as someone who had organized for years and years prior to that, I never dreamed I would see. I dreamt of, but I never dreamt I would actually see it in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. To have such a strong multiracial coalition of folks, led by Black folks and lots of genderqueer and LGBTQ folks in the front lines and in leadership positions, and overall just folks flooding the streets and taking over major cities across the world to say that this wasn't okay and to fight back. That was such a profound moment. That to me, you know, was a utopia. And you could feel it because you would be marching and the streets would be ours. And then you would have to leave or take a break for something or, you know, make a phone call somewhere you could hear it. And so you would dip out for a moment and the cold world of New York would kind of crash back in where that little community that had been created was just gone. And the feeling of going back and forth was so crushing and vivid. It felt like home, you know, to be in this world of people who really were willing to risk themselves for a cause they believed in. That was just so powerful, you know, to feel that. And so I don't necessarily believe in, like, changing the whole of one society to fit one. I don't know how that works. I don't know the answers. I just know that, like, resistance is a form of utopia. And that's a beautiful thing.
And we live in hope.
And we live in hope.
we have to live in hope.
Hard as times are and as bad as things have gotten, we fight and we struggle on and we create art and we have fun and we have parties and we also fight and it's heartbreaking and it's a funeral dirge and it's a mambo all at once.
Right. Better get out there and dance.
Exactly.
You'll love living here. We've been talking with Daniel Jose Older, whose new book from Middle Grade Readers is Dactyl Hill Squad. Daniel, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, there will be a release party for Elise Arden's third book in the Casket Girls series, Cities of the Dead. That's Tuesday, January 22nd at 7 at One Eye Jack's. Tickets available at boutiquedevampire.com. Daniel Jose Older reads from and discusses Dactyl Hill Squad and his other books, Thursday, January 24th at 7 at Dogfish, 2448 North Villery. Jeff O'Hara discusses and signs Have Fun, Fight Back, and Keep the Party Going, Lessons from a New Orleans Entrepreneur's Journey to the Inc. 5000, Thursday, January 24th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Jason Conboy discusses Lost Settlements of Southeast Louisiana, Thursday, January 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of the regularly scheduled meeting of the Jefferson Parish Historical Society. Floyd Clown Sr., a descendant of Crazy Horse, and author-filmmaker William Matson discuss Crazy Horse, The Lakota Warrior's Life and Legacy, Thursday, January 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Lincoln Pierce signs his newest book for young readers, Max and the Midnights, Friday, January 25th at 5 at Octavia Books. There will be a launch party for the new issue of Bayou Magazine, Saturday, January 26th at 7 at Fawn's Lounge, 4229 Dauphine. Ken Waldman is the featured reader Sunday, January 27th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Waldman also appears Monday, January 28th at 7 at Art Club NOLA. Ashley Young facilitates a workshop, Writing Memoir Through Ancestral Narratives, Mondays in February from 6:30 to 9 at the Dragonfly on St. Claude Avenue. For registration and tuition, email info@noladragonfly.com. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library are sponsoring the inaugural Alvar Zine Contest. 2019's theme is Mardi Gras. Make a zine about carnival history, a story taking place during Mardi Gras, a personal memory, or reflection on how the season makes you feel. To enter, submit a print copy of your zine to any New Orleans Public Library location. Electronic submissions, including your name, email, or phone number, and an attachment of your zine may be submitted to contest@nolalibrary.org. The winner receives a Visa gift card and will have 100 copies of their zine printed and distributed at the New Orleans Comics and Zine Festival in April. All entries received will be added to the Alvar Zine Library. The winner will be notified Monday, April 1st. The French Literature Discussion Group reads Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo, beginning Monday, January 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The reading for the first meeting is chapters 1 through 27. The Jefferson Parish Library presents its first digital expo Tuesday, January 29th, from 6:30 to 8:30 at the East Bank Regional Library. This is designed to explain how to enjoy the library's free digital content, which includes ebooks, audiobooks, music, movies, magazines, and comics, all delivered directly to a patron's device: smartphones, laptops, smart TVs, tablets, etc. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harder Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.